You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.
I'm delighted to reconvene our conference, and I do think we have a terrific. It's true, we do have a terrific audience. The audience is the key here. We've got people who are into art and architecture, and then we got people who are into sort of, you know, logistics and sort of details and history. So this is good. So maybe it's like one of those things that shake hands with the architect next to you, or shake hands with the historian next to you. I think we'll do that. You know when you go to various meetings or services or things of that sort. So I think we'll play that game at a certain point. Shake if you find a sociologist and shake their hand. And then find a studio artist and be nice to them too. Anyway, I'm delighted to introduce our second keynote speaker, Mark Levinson, who is an economist and a journalist in New York, and also this is important, and I don't think is a history graduate student also in New York. I think we have to say that. Okay, and yes, let's have a round of hands. And we'll get to that in a second, because you may think he's emeritus already, but no, he's just beginning. He's held staff positions for a couple decades at least with The Economist, with Newsweek, and the Journal of Commerce. And he's written, I think he's the author of at least two books, or if not three, before his current one. One is the A Guide to Financial Markets, which I think was reissued, is that correct, recently? Another one is Beyond Free Markets, The Revival of Activist Economics. I think that first came out in 1988, probably a little bit hopeful, but maybe that'll happen. Okay, and another book, After Reagan, Confronting the Changing the World Economy. So he's been a writer, he's been a journalist, he's been involved in the world of New York commerce and finance. And then I first met Mark at the seminar of a labor historian, Josh Freeman, 3 or 4 years ago, and. You know, he was taking a graduate course at City University of New York, and as I understand it, this book, correct me if I'm wrong, sort of is a kind of came out of a seminar paper that you were writing, something of that sort. You know, sort of emerged out of the general chaos of grad school. The box, how the shipping container made the world smaller and the world economy bigger, and this is a phenomenon. This book is a phenomenon. It's an event. I realized this book, something was going on with this book when I, in the hallway, I met, saw Kim Yasuda, who is a professor of studio art and art here in the IHC, and she had this book tucked under her arm, and it was dog-eared, it was underlined, and I said, what is going on here? If this book is being used and sort of obviously used by a professor of studio art, you know. Then, of course, when it appeared, it was reviewed by everybody. I mean, everybody's had something, could invest in this book. I mean, the Economist, the Business Press, the New York Review of Books, the labor history. I mean, everybody, you know, wants part of this book, and I think that's it's just indicative of a project, an idea that Mark had that really filled a vacuum that had to be filled. And once it was done, everyone said, why didn't I think of that, you know? Right? When it's a good book, you say, why? I could have written that book, you know? All right. I'm really delighted to have Mark here. And you take the stand.
Good afternoon, and I'd like to thank you all for having me here. Let's see. Now, where did this get shipped in from? Well, I don't know, actually. It may or may not have come from across. No, it's from California, so maybe it didn't come in a container. It's quite an honor for me to be invited to come here and speak to you today. And I've got to say that I am really thrilled by the topic of this conference. One of the more surprising things that I discovered in the course of several years' work on containerization is how little serious research has gone on into the container and its many consequences. Conferences such as this, I think, are really important in putting containerization on the agenda for academic research. And I'd certainly like to record my thanks to the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center here and to UCSB for organizing this event. I'm delighted to have the chance to talk about containerization because I rarely did so while I was writing the box. I'd run into my friends and they'd say, "What are you up to?" And I'd say, "I'm working on a book." "What's it on?" they'd say. "It's a history of the shipping container," I would tell them. That response invariably led to a rather embarrassed silence, followed by a change in subject. I was actually appreciative when one of my neighbors asked me flat out, "Who'd want to read a book about that?" Well, then things changed in pretty unexpected ways. No sooner did the book appear than a colleague at my office said to me, "You know, I used to live in a container." Well, no, he was not homeless. He'd actually been in the British Army. And as it turns out, the British Army uses containers as housing units that can be installed quickly in remote locations. An officer gets one to himself, non-commissioned officers share a container, and privates go forward a container. A few weeks later, I met a couple of architects who are currently in the process of erecting an office building made entirely of 40-foot containers. Then I met a man who'd created a containerized art gallery to achieve his ambition of making art accessible to people in working-class neighborhoods. He just moves the container from place to place depending upon where he wants to show the art. Then I heard from a computer company that was developing a data center prepackaged in a container for quick transport to wherever it was needed. A server in a box, they called it. So the lowly container is having influence in many different fields. And I think that this conference will give us a better sense of its importance. Shortly after the box was published, I received a phone call from a man who told me he'd taken a graduate class from one of the country's leading economic historians. The professor, he said, had told his students that the container was one of the more important developments of the 20th century, but that it was so simple there really wasn't much to say about it. That may just have been the greatest compliment I've ever received. I mean, it takes a certain sort of talent to write 300 pages on a subject on which there's nothing to say. But while it's true that the container may be the most boring innovation of all time, the process of creating it was anything but simple. To understand what was involved and why it was so important, we need to step out of the 21st century for a moment and back into the world of the 1950s. Back then, you couldn't just run over to your local store and find merchandise from all over the world. If you were operating a business, almost all of your supplies and your components, other than raw materials, were made nearby. Imports and exports were very small relative to the size of the economy, and trade in manufactured goods was even smaller. Most of what crossed the seas was commodities. Who remembers in the 1950s when U.S. manufacturing was growing very rapidly, who remembers what was America's leading import? Anyone recall? It was coffee beans in burlap bags. Obviously, there were many reasons that international trade hardly registered back in the early 1950s. Countries in Europe and Asia were still suffering the effects of World War II. They didn't have a lot to sell, and they couldn't afford to buy much. Import tariffs, of course, were high almost everywhere. In an era of fixed exchange rates, countries with trade deficits literally had to worry about running out of money, and trade flows were heavily controlled for that reason. All of these factors are well understood, but there was another type of trade barrier that has received much less attention. I'm referring to the cost of freight transportation. For many products, the cost of international transport came to 20 or 25% of the value of the goods themselves, in some cases even more. Moving goods was so expensive that many goods were just not worth moving. Most of this cost was incurred on the dock, where veritable armies of dock workers required days and even weeks to load a single ship. There were 50,000 dock workers in New York City in the early 1950s, another 50,000 in London. That gives you an idea of the magnitudes here. Most of us in this room are too young to remember what freight transportation was like back then, but an unusual U.S. government study offers us some help. The study concerned a ship called the Warrior, which sailed from Brooklyn to Bremerhaven in Germany in March of 1954. Here's what was on board the Warrior: 74,903 cases, 71,726 cartons, 24,036 bags, 10,761 boxes. There was also an assortment of drums, cans, barrels, crates, reels, even a few cars. All told, dock workers in Brooklyn had to remove almost 200,000 separate items from warehouses, assemble them onto wooden pallets, lower the pallets into the hold of the ship, and then remove each of those individual items from the pallet and stow it somewhere in the vessel. Just getting the ship loaded took 6 days. The time required to move the entire load from the date the first goods left a U.S. factory to the date the last goods were delivered in Europe was more than 3 months. The Warrior, by today's standards, was a small ship. It carried about a tenth as much cargo as fits on the average container ship today. So here's a thought experiment for you. Imagine a vessel 10 times the size of the Warrior, carrying 10 times as much cargo, just the way the Warrior carried cargo. Imagine loading that ship with 749,000 cases, 717,000 cartons, 240,000 bags. If you think for a moment about how long it would take dock workers to load 2 million items by hand on board a ship, you'll understand that international trade on today's scale would simply be impossible without containerization. Now, everyone in the 1950s was perfectly aware that the need for all this freight handling was a bottleneck. The solution was obvious. Instead of loading and unloading all of those cases and cartons and bags and bales every time cargo needed to be shifted from a train to a truck or a truck to a ship, why not just put a lot of packages into a container and move the container? The truth is that the idea of putting cargo into containers was not a new idea in the 1950s. Various railroads and ship lines had been doing it for the better part of a century in response to the high cost of handling cargo. You can find photos of intermodal containers in France in the 1890s. The containers were lifted by a winch from a flatbed rail car onto a horse-drawn cart, intermodalism in its early version. In America and Britain and Australia, containers were widely used by the 1920s. European railroads agreed on a standard size for containers in the 1930s. A variety of companies around the world offered intermodal container services. Intermodal means going from ship to truck or truck to train by the early 1950s. None of those early container ventures made much difference to the world. And there are several reasons why this was so. One is that regulators often stood in the way. In the U.S., for example, back in those days, freight rates depended upon the commodity. Usually the price was so much per ton for a given commodity. The Interstate Commerce Commission, which regulated trucks and railroads, insisted back in the 1930s that the rates for shipping a ton of a good in a container should be exactly identical to the rates for shipping a ton of the same good as loose freight. In other words, there was no money to be saved by using a container. Of course, nobody was in a big hurry to use containers. The early technology wasn't terribly efficient either. Many of the early containers were made of heavy steel, so a quarter of the weight of a loaded container was the container itself. That was not hugely sensible. Other containers were made of wood. They were sometimes liable to break apart during shipment. Labor unions stood in the way of containerization in the early days, and not just the dock unions. In the U.S., for example, the Teamsters Union negotiated contracts that made it all but impossible for some shippers to send truck trailers on trains. Another obstacle came from the fact that ships and trucks and rail cars were not designed for containers. But probably the biggest reason containerization went nowhere in those early days, in my view, was that transportation companies themselves didn't want it to go anywhere. By and large, the transport industry saw containerization as a good thing so far as it would reduce costs, but a bad thing if it might increase competition. That's one reason that by the late 1950s, containers came in many different shapes and sizes. Sealand, the company created by the U.S. trucking entrepreneur Malcolm McLean, used a 35-foot container. Matson Line, which served California and Hawaii, used a 24-foot container. One early system in Canada had 8-foot containers. Another system used in the Puerto Rico trade had containers that were 7 feet long. The New York Central and Missouri Pacific Railroads both had container systems, but they were totally incompatible. If you shipped a container from Texas to St. Louis on the Missouri Pacific, you couldn't move it on to New York on the New York Central, and you certainly couldn't move it on board a ship. These differences allowed each individual company to hold on to its customers, to protect its business, but it also meant that most shippers didn't really find containerization very useful. A shipper in Topeka could not fill a container and be confident that it would be delivered in Tokyo or even in Tacoma. This brief description of the obstacles explains why, in my view, Malcolm McLean deserves so much credit in the containerization story. He's often labeled as the inventor of containerization, and that's clearly not right. McLean's real contribution to the story, in my view, didn't have to do with boxes and ships, but with mindset. His view was that freight is freight. Customers, he thought, didn't care how their freight moved. They were not interested in the trucks and the ships and the trains. They just wanted their goods delivered cheaply, safely, and on time. At this point, I want to interject a detail for the benefit of the historians in the room. In his older years, people frequently asked Malcolm McLean how he came up with the idea of the container. McLean recounted that when he was a truck driver, he'd started out driving his own truck in the 1930s, and McLean said that once he'd sat for hours at a pier in New Jersey waiting to unload bales of cotton on board a ship. And while he was sitting there, he thought to himself, wouldn't it be easier if we could just load the truck trailer on board the ship? This brainstorm supposedly developed into containerization 20 years later. Well, my own judgment is that this epiphany never occurred. As I've told you already, the idea of shipping goods in containers was around a long time before Malcolm McLean. But what has fascinated me is that even if this story isn't true, people love it. This reflects a widespread misconception about technological innovation. Readers really eat up the idea of the inspired genius, the bolt from the blue, the apple falling on Isaac Newton's head. They really like the idea that Malcolm McLean was sitting there at the dock one day and bang, he had the idea for the container. Explaining the reality that innovation occurs in erratic steps with one person building upon the work of other people is really a tough sell for the historian. But back to Malcolm McLean. As I've indicated, his most important contribution to the development of containerization was the insight that freight is freight. In 2007, this insight sounds pretty simple. In 1956, when McLean's first container ship set sail, this insight was revolutionary because it implied that the transport industry was looking at the world all wrong. Back then, ship lines thought their business was shipping, railroads thought their business was railroading, truckers thought their business was trucking. And McLean said, nope, nobody really cares what your business is. Looking back from the 21st century now helps us understand the mentality that Malcolm McLean was fighting. That mentality held that the world is a pretty static place. In a static world, there's only so much freight to go around. So any change that means more for you means less for me. In that world, the smartest strategy is to fight change. The history of containerization reveals that sort of thinking again and again. Through the 1960s, U.S. railroads fought containerization tooth and nail because they were convinced that containerization would mean the end of their boxcar business. Well, they were right. But then again, no one in the railroad industry back then foresaw, even remotely imagined, that North America's railroads would one day move 12 million containers in a single year, which is what they're going to do in 2007. The container is the most profitable freight on the rails today. None of the folks in the railroad industry who fought containerization in the 50s and 60s and 70s thought that far ahead. The many trucking executives who bitterly opposed U.S. transport deregulation in the 1970s didn't have an inkling of the international cargo that would come their way after deregulation opened the way to lower cost international trade. They just saw the risks that they might lose some business. And let's not forget the union folks. The local union leaders at the Port of Los Angeles in 1960 declined to handle containers because they thought that containers would mean the end of the Port of Los Angeles. As we'll see on Saturday firsthand, that assertion proved just a little bit wide of the mark. The container has helped change many aspects of the world economy by dramatically altering the economics of freight transportation. I would argue, as Nelson said earlier, that today's globalized economy could not have come about if longshoremen were still loading vessels one bag and one barrel at a time. This has had some extremely positive consequences for consumers around the world in terms of lowering costs, in terms of increasing the variety of goods in the stores. It's probably made a significant contribution to economic health, to economic growth. But at a more detailed level, the consequences of containerization are much more nuanced, and they continue to unfold. I would like to highlight three, all of which I think offer some opportunities for future research. One is the changing role of ports. If you go back and read about what was written about freight transportation in the 30s or the 50s or even the early 1970s, you'll see some startling terminology. You'll come across the word tributary, for example. What tributary meant was that a certain geographic territory was the captive customer of a particular port city. The port city prospered by exercising a chokehold over the region's economy. Another word common in this older literature is natural, associated with the flow of cargo. Natural implied that there was a correct path for a shipment to follow between two points, a sort of law of physics governing cargo. By this logic, moving cargo over an unaccustomed routing or through a new transfer point might be considered a crime against nature. This way of thinking has gone the way of breakbulk cargo. In the container area, there are no natural routings, and there are no more tributaries. Nelson mentioned earlier the possibility that the paths of distribution may now be the fixed factor of production rather than the location of manufacturing. I'm not sure that's true. No matter how deep a harbor, and no matter how easy its rail connections, they cannot guarantee the flow of traffic through a port. The customer, who is most likely a manufacturer or a retailer, has a container in Mumbai and wants to move it to Minneapolis. The customer doesn't much care whether it goes through the Suez Canal or the Panama Canal, whether it's trucked from Port Newark to Minneapolis, or whether it's barged up the Mississippi River from New Orleans, or whether it goes on a ship to Vancouver and then rides the train to Minneapolis. All of these routes, all of these ports are in competition. This has obvious implications for the bargaining power of port and terminal operators, railroads, truck lines, and workers in the longshore, rail, and trucking industries. Nelson suggested earlier that we've seen a shift of power to groups of workers in some areas. And indeed, this is the case with containerization because port workers in particular have gained bargaining power from the fact that it is very, very costly to the ship owner for the ship to be delayed. And so they're willing to pay a great deal of money to keep the port operating. On the other hand, the ship owners and their customers are not wedded to a port, and this is going to tend to reduce the bargaining power of all of the factors of labor that are associated with the report, with the port. Just to give you one example, the West Coast dock strike in 2002, and you're welcome. Excuse me. You're welcome. You're welcome to address that later. The congestion in the Western railroads in 2005 and 2006 has led several major companies to open warehouses in places such as Houston and Savannah. Not necessarily to reduce costs, but to reduce risks from disruption. The literature on port competition doesn't really look at competition among routings, largely because it's very difficult to get a handle on all of the costs relevant to corporate decision making. And I think this is a subject that would really benefit from a microanalysis of individual shippers' decisions. The relevant data may be hard to come by, believe me, I've tried, but I suspect that some of them may be available. A second subject that has not been well explored is the connection between transport deregulation and economic concentration. As I show in the box, containerization was an important source of pressure for the deregulation of freight transport, mainly because most of the old regulatory concepts really didn't fit the container. Those old concepts, as I mentioned, are based on a commodity-specific price, and that made sense when freight was shipped loose. Some freight took more time to load than other freight. Some freight took up more space in a ship or on a train than other freight. But the commodity-based rates didn't really make any sense at all in a container. It costs just as much to load one container as another. And this really exerted a lot of pressure for the end of the old regulatory regime in which one had to apply to the Interstate Commerce Commission for permission to charge a specific rate. One result of deregulation is that most freight, and certainly most international freight, now moves under contract. This is an aspect of deregulation that really hasn't gotten much attention. Most people talk about rates themselves, but I'd argue that contracting, and particularly confidential contracting, is probably more important than the freedom to set rates. The terms of these contracts are undisclosed, so we really don't know who pays what to ship goods. My suspicion, however, is that deregulation benefits big shippers over small shippers in two ways. First, a company that's shipping 10,000 containers a month obviously has a lot more bargaining power with ship lines, truck lines, and railroads than a company that ships 10 containers a month. Second, when rates are secret, a big shipper that's constantly negotiating rates has better information about rates. It knows what current prices are, whereas a small shipper just doesn't go into the market very often. So the big shipper can bargain more intelligently. Both of these factors would seem to give big companies a significant competitive advantage against small companies. This is one of these ideas that makes perfect sense to me. So far, I haven't been able to prove it because the data, as I say, are hard to come by, but I hereby invite all of you to try to prove it. A third subject that's calling for attention, in my view, is the potential reshaping of supply chains due to changes in costs. And I'm going to point out several of these things. When environmental laws started coming into force in California in the 1960s and in the rest of the U.S. in the 1970s, ports and ship lines basically got a free pass. So did railroads. Those days are now over. The current effort to reduce pollution at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach is expected to cost more than $10 billion. And other ports are undertaking similar initiatives. Those costs will be loaded on every container passing through the ports. Efforts to address climate change are inevitably going to make freight transportation more expensive. In the United States, we have a significant history of underinvestment in transport infrastructure, both public infrastructure and private infrastructure, which is serving to make freight transportation less reliable, and lower reliability means that shippers have to carry more inventory to protect against disruption. That's a cost, too. So all of these factors are raising rates. Anecdotally, I hear a lot of stories now that manufacturers are moving some of their production from Asia to Mexico or even back to the United States in order to reduce supply chain risks and costs. I hope we'll have some research on sourcing strategies to explore this development. Will these rising costs reverse the trend to globalization that the container helped bring about? Well, I admit to being an economist, and I readily acknowledge that over the last half century, economists have shown themselves to be singularly unskilled at evaluating the potential of containerization. One need only consider the foresight of the Harvard economists who opined back in 1959 that containerization would aid New York City's garment industry by making it cheaper to send clothing from New York to the South. Or you can think about the economists for a famous consulting firm who opined in 1967 that 5 container ships would suffice to move all of the trade between the United States and Great Britain. Or you can think about the economic analysts in the mid-1960s who said that container shipping would never work across the Pacific Ocean. The distances were just too great. With those unfortunate examples in the forefront of my mind, I would suggest that we face some significant questions about whether international trade can continue to grow at the rate that containerization has made possible. Trade has really thrived on the economies of scale in shipping. But as ships and ports get bigger, these economies may be turning into diseconomies. Security concerns are likely to raise shippers' costs. Environmental worries are making it harder to expand ports and rail yards. Rising wages and strong currencies across Asia are making exports less attractive. And, of course, shipments that made economic sense when oil was $20 a barrel may not be viable at $80 or $100 a barrel. Expanding international trade in the future may not be as easy as it was in the past. In its first half century, the boring old shipping container has opened the way for economic changes that no one dreamed of in the 1950s. I think plenty more changes are yet to come, but I really am reluctant to offer a prediction. If there's one thing that we can learn for sure from the history of containerization, it's that we should be very humble when it comes to making forecasts. Thank you very much. happy to take questions.
Thank you, Nelson. I'm David Benzman from Rutgers University. I really enjoyed being provoked by Mark Levinson and his book, and I had a few thoughts that I was wondering if he could help me to understand better. It seems to me that, you know, one aspect of the container revolution that you described has played itself out to a large extent, and I feel like we're stuck now with lack of implementation of the capacities for further improvements in freight movement the way the world was in the 50s. Which it seems to me that we have the capacity to process information that would make it possible to move freight a lot more quickly than it's moving now. But that technology, the computer software programs, and the way that they could link up different modes of freight transportation aren't being used very effectively. And I'm wondering if you could give us any insight into why the logistics industry worldwide is so slow to take advantage of the possibilities. Another example that's occurred to me is, it seems like after the Port of New York facilitated the revolution that you wrote about by helping to build the container port in Elizabeth, it's kind of retreated from that activist model and is now more interested in real estate development and turning the waterfront of New Jersey into a high-end real estate location than it is in keeping the Port of New York a world-leading logistics station. And I'm wondering if you could explain some of the things that stand in the way of, you know, economic change.
Okay, a couple of good questions. On the first one, you know, when I talk at places where there are a lot of students around, I often offer them great ideas for making money. And here's one. We've got containerization. It's going great guns. It's done truly marvelous things for the world economy in many ways. There are some significant gaps. For example, no one has yet found an efficient way to use railroads for relatively short distance transportation. If you can figure that one out, there's a lot of money to be made. Right now, containers come into the port of L.A. and Long Beach, and they get put on a train that runs straight through to Chicago. And it's a very efficient way to run operations. However, if the containers are going to Phoenix or Las Vegas, they don't get put on a train because the cost of loading and operating the train over short distances is really not competitive. And as a result of that, the highways are really littered with trucks that may not need to be there. This is an area where there just has been no technological innovation. I know that some folks at the railroads have basically thought about it and have given up. I'm not convinced that it's an area where there can be no innovation, but is really one of the things that is striking that no one anywhere in the world really uses the rail system very efficiently over short distances. And deregulation has not helped that at all. So that is one partial answer to your question. I want to talk for a sec about the ports. In the early days of containerization, the port owners, who tended to be in the public sector, local port agencies, city governments, state governments, county governments, put up a lot of the money to build container ports. These days, that is not happening, as was pointed out here. I would say that in some ways that's a good thing and not a bad thing. The port operating business has pretty much moved into the private sector, which is to say the ports are still owned in most places by a government agency, but they are leased out to a private terminal operator. The reason that this is happening, there is twofold. One is that these things are pretty capital intensive. It takes a lot of money to run a container port, and there is a question about whether you want public money to be put at risk here. But the second part of this is that a lot of the bargaining power here has shifted to the ship lines, and they have the ability to change routings, as indicated. They can use that ability to play one port off against another. And so it's really quite dangerous for a public agency to be making an investment in a port. What you see now is that many of the world's leading terminals are being run by private companies, often in some form of joint venture with a ship line or in some form of contract with a ship line. And that addresses this risk. Okay, if the ship line is a joint venture partner in the port, it's not just going to pick up and leave the port with unused facilities. If the ship line is a tenant in a publicly owned port, it'll say goodbye, and the public is going to be stuck with the debts. So that's really why there has been this shift to private terminal operation, and I don't think it's going to go back the other way. The public agencies definitely have a role in overseeing the terminals. They have a role in making sure that the terminals don't get turned into condominiums, but they probably don't need to be actually operating the terminals and subjecting the public to this financial risk.
Many mics. Hi. It's toward the end there you were talking about the container as a good thing because it seemed to neutrally add to more economic growth and more trade, which I'm not at all convinced about that being a better thing. And I'm wondering if you could talk specifically about the role of containerization, and maybe you do this in the book, but I'd love to hear you spin it out, what you think the specific role of containerization in particular is in the global depression of labor standards. And we laugh at the example of the garments going, they're not going to be able to go to the South, like as if how stupid they were. And of course it led to the containerization makes it possible for those garments to come from China or Honduras or Mexico, not necessarily Mexico, rather than from New Jersey or New York at union weights that people had fought for many years. So I'm wondering if you could just talk about what you think the specific role is of containerization in that global search for cheaper labor and lower environmental standards, and if that sheer volume that it unleashes, how big a factor you think that is.
Well, I'm going to take issue with your characterization here of a global depression in labor standards. I would argue that for most workers in the United States, their labor standards are better now than they were when the container came on the scene. I would argue that for most workers in China, their labor standards are better now than they were when the container came on the scene. So I would dispute the notion that there has been a global depression in labor standards. I think it's very clear that the container benefited the world in terms of consumption, and I think it's very clear that the container has imposed costs on some people in the world economy by making production more mobile. It's certainly created some jobs. It's created a lot of jobs in areas that didn't exist so far. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of people in this country who work in an industry known as logistics. Many of them work with computers and software. It's a pretty high-tech industry, actually. This was an industry that didn't exist before the container. On the other hand, it certainly created a competition that was not there previously because of the cost of imports, and that has definitely hurt the U.S. manufacturing sector. But the economy is full of change. The economy always changes, and economic change always creates winners and losers. So I don't think that in that regard the container is different from most other forms of economic change. I think that people tend to get sometimes a little misty-eyed about how good things were in the good old days. Okay, those folks, for example, who worked in the garment industry in New York City, the 1950s, or 1960s even, before we started getting containerized imports, they may have been union members. Their jobs paid horribly. They were well below the average for U.S. manufacturing workers. They had enormous turnover in those jobs because people hated working in that industry, so as soon as they could find a job that paid better somewhere else, they left it and went into a different line of work. Those jobs typically lasted a few months, and then people were unemployed, and then they had to find work again at a different garment plant. So, you know, the good old days of memory are not necessarily what people actually had on the job. But, you know, I would not dispute at all the idea that containerization, like any other economic change, created winners and losers. By lowering the cost of one aspect of commerce, transportation, it made other aspects, other costs, more important. And that definitely made labor costs loom more important. It definitely made environmental costs loom more important in decisions about where to locate production. I would not argue with that at all. That's absolutely correct.
Alan Cicula, California Institute of the Arts. Just this last exchange makes me want to say one thing. I would propose that meatpacking would be an industry where the conditions of work have declined precipitously since the 1950s. If you compare, you know, large-scale Iowa City Armor, these kinds of firms of the time with the current immigrant working, the kind of bloody Taylorist speed-up of immigrant worker meat labor-intensive meat processing, it's hands down, it's worse now. But since the main reason I wanted to say something is because this question of the fixity of sea routes and the fluidity of manufacturing. Since Nelson was more or less paraphrasing something I said, I should clarify, and I don't think you're familiar with what I've done on this subject, so even though we've been on the radio together, which you may not remember, the point I was making is that the historical relation between land and sea has been reversed. That the sea always represented the problem of fluidity, of a kind of untamable, even sublime fluidity. And so if we look back to, say, the first industrial revolution, factories pretty much had fixed sites. The sites were invented, were found. In the Midlands in England, for example, and sea routes were unpredictable. Of course, steam brought in a level of predictability with sailing schedules. So in the long, in terms of long duration or the long durée, I think one can speak of this inversion. I absolutely agree with you that ports compete. And of course, they're all the fears, you know, the dock workers in Los Angeles fear that, you know, San Quintin might become a kind of megaport dispatching feeder vessels. It's not clear what the future of Hong Kong will be with this kind of mad competition in China, but I think there is an issue here of the kind of irrationality of and the non-planned character of this advanced capitalist system. It's the sort of issue that Robert Brenner talks about in his book, The Boom and the Bubble, you know, which is that the rationality, and it's also something that's been understood by Marxist cultural historians like Lukács, you know, that the rationality of a profession, say the logistics expert, is exercised within a kind of constrained sphere. But what isn't understood is the larger, you know, interlockings of the pieces of the puzzle. So it's not clear in China, which has probably the most, you know, what remains the most powerful command economy with some notion of central planning, you know, sometimes admirable in a way, because of the, you know, population problems, problems of distribution of resources, the sense that there is someone in charge, which isn't clear at all in the United States in terms of questions of logistics, for example. You have this sort of mad scramble of local bureaucrats, as far as I can understand it, to sort of make each port the great port. What happens to Hong Kong? What happens to Hong Kong with this immense capital investment? What happens when it's no longer necessary for Taiwanese capital to be filtered through Hong Kong in order to be invested in say the new in Shenzhen or in, you know, the South China sort of Guangdong province area? I mean, I've visited former sweatshops in Hong Kong in the port district that are now empty. They had a stage where they had a tiny office with a fax machine that was basically sending orders that were coming in from, say, Kaohsiung or Taipei onto a factory in South China. And now those little front offices are closing, so you get a second order of dereliction. So what is the future of Hong Kong in terms of urban policy in China? So I think in the same way when you make the point about the truck-train relation in terms of immediate or sort of near hinterland transport, okay, it's extremely efficient for the shipping companies to allow a kind of anarchy of organization of local trucking and local delivery to exist with something like 700 of these little trucking companies that keep changing their names, that hire immigrant drivers who buy beat-up used freightliners with bald tires, you know, and hump these things back and forth for what turns out, under the rubric of being owner-operators, this irrationality is profitable, right? So of course no one's going to come up with a train solution. It's also not clear physically that you can engineer, you know, train lengths in relation to dock sizes to distribute local cargo. Of course, the myth was produced with the production of the building of the Alameda Corridor in Los Angeles that this was somehow going to take trucks off the street. It didn't, right? Because we know that the local transport is largely truck transport. And local means this huge consumer area that is Southern California and the Southwest and the immediate Southwest. So I think there's this question of this sort of irrationality of the system that coexists with this highly rationalized distribution model.
Well, you know, the phrase that you use, irrationality, when people talk about rationality in economics, that usually means that they're trying to protect their profits against somebody else. And so you get a regulatory system that provides rationality, and it does it by reducing competition so that people can't enter, so that people can't innovate. When you have an increased level of competition, you have irrationality. There's no question about it. You have more churn. You have people going out of business. You have existing enterprises facing new levels of competition that they can't withstand. And we know that that is, A, something that brings improved productivity and thereby economic growth, and B, that it has a lot of costs along the way. I don't think that those things are new. So I think irrationality is part and parcel of an economy that is growing. I would just point out, and I'm going to have to stop here, that we went in this country through probably 15 to 20 years of trying to figure out how to deregulate the transport industries without hurting anybody. Okay. Congress really, starting in the late 1940s even, started discussing a deregulation. The phrase wasn't used then, but shippers wanted more flexibility to get freedom to ship with different carriers. They wanted more flexibility for their carriers to set rates. And there were great investigations about how this could be done while at the same time not hurting the truck lines and not hurting the railroads and not hurting the workers in those industries. And the result of that was that basically very little happened in deregulation because this problem was not solvable. Okay. If we were going to deregulate, if we were going to have innovation in this area, if we were going to have more competition and reduced prices, people were going to get hurt. There was no question about it, and that's exactly what happened. So I think that the idea that we can have economic growth and economic change without what you term irrationality, I think that idea is not on at all. I think that irrationality is, in fact, part of economic growth and innovation.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.